All right, good morning. This is a public rulemaking hearing held in accordance with the State Administrative Procedure Act, CRS 244103, Colorado Revised Statutes. The date is Tuesday, October 3rd. The time is 9:30 a.m., and we are meeting in the Secretary of State's Aspen Conference Room on the third floor of the Office of the Secretary of State at 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. I'm Deputy Secretary of State Suzanne Steyer. I'm convening this hearing in accordance with the rulemaking notice published in the Colorado Register on September 10, 2017. Joining me today to my right is Stephen Bowie, Campaign and Political Finance Manager in the Elections Division. To my left is Melissa Polk, our Legal Unit Manager in the Elections Division. And to my far left, Andrea Geiger, our Department Rulemaking Manager in the Administration Division. The purpose of this hearing is to receive comments from the public on proposed amendments to the Secretary of State's campaign and political finance rules, and as stated in the notice, the purpose of the rulemaking is to consider rule revisions that are necessary, and those reasons are published and on the table in the back in our statement of basis. The Secretary of State released a preliminary draft of proposed rules with the notice of rulemaking on September 28th. Revised proposed draft rules were made available to the public. Both drafts are available on the office website. Copies of the notice of rulemaking, revised draft statement of basis, and revised draft rules are available on the table in the back of the room. This is a formal rulemaking hearing. This meeting is audio recorded, and all comments become part of the official legal record. Hearing is also being broadcast over the internet. For anyone who wishes to testify at this hearing, there are sign-up sheets on the table in the back of the room. You must sign up in order to testify. For the record, our office has received written comments on the proposed rules. As we receive comments, they become part of the official record of this hearing. At this time, all interested parties have an opportunity to submit any data views or arguments on amendments to the campaign and political finance rules in writing and, if desired, orally. I'll state now and then at the end that the record will remain open until the close of business Tuesday, October 10th, 2017, to allow the submission of additional written comments. So we only have one person signed up to testify, so Peg Pearl. Oh, one more. Okay. We'll go ahead and start with Peg. Oh, did you? Oh, you said yes. Okay.
Make sure that came up too.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
Morning.
My name is Peg Pearl. I'm an attorney with the consulting firm Democracy TNG. I'm just here representing myself, not for any particular client, as an attorney with over a dozen years of campaign finance, policy, and enforcement experience at the federal, state, and local level. And I just have a couple comments on a couple of different rules. I did not submit something in writing, and I'm not planning to, so just wanted to point out a couple things at the hearing today. The first would be on rule or 1.7, which would be, here we go. The difference is, I understand this rule to be trying to give more guidance on the line between independent expenditure committees and political committees. Now that we're almost 8 years out from the Citizens United decision, everything in the aftermath of various court decisions since, and what the differences between those types of committees are. I agree with what the rule says, and I've also read the Ethics Watch comments that I saw online last night that touch on this, and I agree with their point, but my comment's a little different. There's a number of ways that independent expenditure committees and PACs are different, and I'm just somewhat worried that by only putting this one point in the rule in the way that it's written right now, it perhaps neglects those other items and might lead to some confusion. So, specifically, while it's true that independent expenditure committees cannot coordinate with candidates or parties and that a political committee can, a political committee doesn't have to do coordination, right? So a political committee could also do some independent expenditures. So as opposed to the language in the rule here, which says an IEC committee differs from a political committee because an IEC committee does not coordinate, it's actually a little more accurate to say that an IEC cannot coordinate, whereas a PAC may, but is not required to. And so you could say cannot or may not instead of does not. And that way you're not assuming that 100% of the PACs are coordinating because they don't have to. They could be doing independent expenditures as well. That's a definitional matter and a practical matter. We just know that's what happens, and that's allowed under the definition. So that would be a suggestion there. Also, as the Ethics Watch comments pointed out, political committees can give contributions to candidates and PACs and stuff, and IECs cannot. That's a very important distinction that's probably worth pointing out. And finally, there's a little ambiguity, perhaps, about electioneering communications. I don't know if that's something you want to address in this rule or not, but I think there's a fair reading of the specific statute, which talks about independent expenditures being the trigger for registering an independent expenditure committee, not electioneering communications. And so PACs or political organizations, 527s, might be doing independent or might be doing electioneering communications, as opposed to an IE committee, which would be doing independent expenditures, but not if you're only doing ECs. So just something to think about that's a little more nebulous than the first two points. But again, I think by only highlighting one thing in the rule, it might be giving a little bit of false sense of security that that's the only difference and that it's a more dramatic difference than it actually is.
Okay.
So that's my comment on that rule. I don't know if you have any questions about how I explain that, but.
Do you think, so I mean, on the other side of it, do you mm-hmm. think the rule should say, maybe instead of pointing out the differences, that in order to be defined as a political committee, you must show that there was a contribution or coordination? Or do you think there are other factors that make you a political committee?
It might actually be easier to flip it on its head, which is, remember, independent expenditure committees really come up as sort of a constitutional exception because of Citizens United. Right. So instead of trying to say, if you do these three things, you're a political committee, and I know there's multiple rules that all kind of work together, it might actually be easier to say that the only way you can be an independent expenditure committee, which is sort of an exception from the rules that we have in the Constitution, is if you don't give money to candidates, if you don't coordinate with candidates, if you don't, you know, kind of make it that way instead of trying to define it in the other direction for the political committee.
But then doesn't political committee end up swallowing everything that isn't an IEC?
Well, no, because we do have those rules set up for like a political organization or a small donor committee or those other kinds of rules sort of set their boundaries there. So for example, you do still have the political organizations that could be doing, they could be doing electioneering communications, right? But they're registered under political organization because they don't meet the definition of political committee, either because of major purpose or they're not giving money to candidates, you know, those other types of things. But that already pre-exists in the rule. If the confusion's really about when you're in an independent expenditure committee bucket, then I think it's probably simpler to draw what the IE committee bucket looks like, since that's the exception.
What if you're an IE that didn't coordinate and didn't contribute, but you did raise $1,000 to support a candidate? Aren't you also then, isn't there confusion about whether you're also a political committee, which then you just violated campaign finance contribution limits potentially?
Well, I think we have two issues. So there's the constitutional issue, right? And then there's what the statute says. So our statute says that you register as an IE committee if you've raised $1,000 for independent expenditures,
right?
And that's an IE committee. The constitutional question coming out of Citizens United and then actually almost a year later, the Speech Now case from the D.C. Circuit is saying that even if you're an entity who is working with candidates, if all you're doing is independent activity, you can't constitutionally have the contribution limits applied to your action, which is why at the federal level, they're like the super PACs. They're a type of political committee instead of something different, which is how our statute was written before that full cycle of Speech Now and the later cases came into being. So I think it's not necessarily that automatically you would get thrown into the political committee bucket with all the requirements that apply because there's that overlay of constitutional concerns.
Okay.
And I understand there's some cases trickling up. A lot of them are on appeal and things too, but we do have what the statute says, and then we do have these constitutional overlays. Just like major purpose itself, remember, is a constitutional overlay. It's not in the language of the article. So to the extent it's a constitutional construct by courts, it can be changed later through constitutional constructs by courts. And so that's all kind of working itself out. And I know these are the things you have to juggle.
Yeah. So I appreciate that. Thanks.
Okay. And that sort of, I guess, goes to the series of rules that all kind of reach at that. So I'm not going to talk about those separately. The next one I did want to make a specific point about was proposed rule 10.4.6 about the contributions from a joint account. My understanding this rule is it basically is allowing the committee, when it receives a check from a joint account, to presumptively reattribute between two people on the account, whoever they may be, spouses, joint account holders, whoever they might be on the check. And basically my comment here is based on my time working at the Federal Election Commission with federal law, this is not unheard of. There is a presumption reattribution rule at the federal level. At the federal level, there is some additional safeguards because you do want to avoid that prohibition of giving money in the name of another. So at the federal level, the guardrails are is that when you do that type of presumptive reattribution and you take that what might be $800 check, split it in half, say it's $400 and $400, you have to give notice to those contributors that you've done it, and there has to be basically an opt-out period. I believe it's around 60 days. For them to come back to you and say, no, wait, that's not what we wanted or whatever. And it could be because they didn't want it at all and it was just a mistake and they want the money refunded, and you have to be prepared to refund it within that time. If it is asked, it could be that the attribution wanted to be different, something along those lines. So I would urge that to be included in this rule if you're going to go ahead and codify a rule on this issue of reattribution, that there be a notice and an opt-out slash refund demand requirement added in as well.
So you don't have an issue with the rule itself, but just that the candidate or committee would determine, but that the candidate or committee would send out a notice saying this is what we determined.
My understanding from reading the statutes and the articles, there isn't a statute that this type of rule would be working against. There's been some guidance in the manual, but a manual isn't necessarily legally enforcing. I would rather have things in a regulation than a manual to begin with. And so if you're going to put it in the regulation, like I said, this isn't unheard of. It is similar to the federal rule. I just would want the full federal rule with the protections in there.
Okay, thank you. Do you happen to know that rule, just so we can?
No, because they changed all the numbers.
That's fine. We'll find it.
Well, they changed all the statutory sites, and then I guess the CFR is the same, but I don't know it off the top of my head. It's a very long string.
Yeah.
All right. And then the last proposed rule that I wanted to comment about is 18.2.3. And 18.2.3, I understand to be a rule seeking to implement Health Bill 1155 from last session. I was at those legislative hearings and testified in favor of that carefully crafted bill on behalf of my former employer. And the changes that that bill makes to 145-109 basically create a very carefully circumscribed opportunity to cure certain deficiencies in reports. And so the guide rails put into place in that bill are very important. And so the implementation of that bill, I think, is got to be very careful and very important here. So in order to ensure compliance with the law and not shift incentives away from careful record keeping and reporting, that set up that the cure period, or the cure remedy rather, is only applicable in two cases. Either a committee has to show a good faith effort to make timely and proper disclosures, or that the disclosure by the committee is made in substantial compliance. So you've got two possible things to argue. And the reason I emphasize that is it's very important to keep those two things separate and distinct. And I think the overall problem with the rule as written here in the proposal is it meshes and makes circular those two concepts by making sort of substantial compliance part of the definition of good faith and making good faith part of the definition of substantial compliance. And I'll kind of walk through what I mean by that. But they need to be two wholly separate grounds and possible alternative grounds that somebody would be arguing to the ALJ that they require the cure remedy for. So, for example, the general factors in here, looking at 18.2.3, if you go right now to 18.2.3D, this is generally the factors to be looked at for substantial compliance, but subset D says one of the factors for determining substantial compliance is whether it can be inferred that the respondent made a good faith effort. So to me, that's conflating those two possible routes to the cure remedy and needs to be struck completely out of the internal definition of substantial compliance and would be just good faith. The concept needs to be in that separate section of 18.2.4 instead. So the substantial compliance factors should really be focused on an objective list of factors. What legal reporting or record keeping requirements were they met? How close were you to meeting them? What did you do to meet them? So looking at the factors here, A, I would say is fine, the extent to noncompliance, right? That would be fine. C, whether you sought and received guidance from Secretary of State's office, I also think would be fine, but I would add in the idea that you actually followed the guidance, right? Because you don't want it to be that you called, you asked what you should do, and then you blatantly disregarded it. Okay. So by making the call, you don't get credit. So A would be fine. C, with that idea that you followed SOS guidance, that could be a factor that is considered here. B, the purpose of the violation, I think is wholly inappropriate here because the purpose of the law is really outside the scope of the power of the committee who's has to comply with the law. No matter what you think the purpose of the law is as a committee, you need to just comply with the letter of the law of what it is you have to report, not use your own judgment and substitute instead. If I report it this way, I actually think that gets at a better result and serves the purpose better. So I think that an inquiry into purpose and more likely a showing into purpose, remember the committee has the burden of proving good faith or substantial compliance to the ALJ. So they would have to come in and give some sort of evidentiary hearing as to the purpose of a provision. That doesn't seem to make sense, going back into legislative history or something. Really, I think this is inappropriate for substantial compliance. It should be more, what does the rule say you did? Did you do it?
Well, I mean, these are based on petition law, basically, when you look at substantial compliance. And so, I mean, except for C about the guidance, I think A, B, and D were taken right out of. And so I think we were trying to provide something that already had some body of case law so that we didn't have to relitigate it. But I don't know how B is viewed in that context, but it seems to me it would be essentially the same, argument that you would have on a petition, that it's not for the committee to elect to decide what the purpose of the petition was, but, that does come up in petition hearings and is argued. And
maybe that could be something, that was kind of a general comment I was going to make sort of about this rule, which is that perhaps the purpose of the rule here, because when we talked about the legislation with the General Assembly, it was that substantial compliance and good faith were standards that were already in the law, and ALJ and a court would know how to apply them. So to the extent that a regulation needs to be here, perhaps really the purpose is to give it a few factors that are non-exclusive factors for the ALJ to consider that give the specific context of a campaign finance case. What's different here, maybe, than those other places where substantial compliance arises? So maybe by making this a non-exhaustive list of factors, if in a particular case it arises that an ALJ thinks the purpose is relevant based on other types of cases that they do substantial compliance, maybe they'll take a look at that. But it seems like the way this is written right now, it's mandated as something that must be considered and evaluated. received in every case and must be put on as a showing in every case, and I don't think that's an appropriate way to deal with it in the context of campaign finance. So that would be the types of changes I would make to 18.2.3, and again, removing D because it talks about good faith. And actually, what I would do is I would use what was in D as the standard more for 18.2.4, because the currently drafted 18.2.4 basically uses a quantitative percentage type substantial compliance idea for good faith, which is actually more of a little qualitative intent type, standard instead. So if you wanted to take the idea from D, move that down instead to form the basis of your good faith standard about whether or not there's an intent to mislead the electorate or an intent to evade the reporting requirements or something like that, that would make more sense than the percentage. I think the percentage is problematic no matter where you put it, because I don't know what your baseline would be. If your baseline is this filing, if your baseline is every filing you've ever done because you're a committee that's been around for 20 years, if you're a first-time filer, like those types of things, I'm not sure the percentage is an appropriate standard to use anywhere. But definitely not as a good faith indicator. I think good faith is more qualitative and more about the intent. Okay. And that's the kind of showing that a person would make.
What about having that purpose of the provision violated down in good faith? B. What about moving B down? What about moving B and D down to good faith?
That could be a consideration by the ALJ. Again, I just hate to mandate that as an analysis in every single case. We know what campaign finance law is like and the purpose of a provision at the time it was enacted before Citizens United. Is that even relevant necessarily after Citizens United, depending on the provision? Just
so
having
that
mandated. If it was a May and it was within more of the qualitative discussion of good faith, it seems that it might make more sense in a discussion of a good faith showing.
Okay.
Especially if then it's contrasted with an intent to evade requirements or mislead the electorate or you know, something like that, depending on how you would phrase the standard.
Okay.
That might be a better way to do it. So those are basically the suggestions I would make to be able to make sure that these are still two, because they would be alternative grounds, and you might have a committee that would go in on one and not the other. I would think arguably you'd never get to good faith unless you couldn't show substantial compliance. You know, it's kind of like a tiered of what you would try to do in court, because if you substantially complied, that's going to be your best argument. But if something happened and it went really awry, then you're down at good faith, and that's what you'd want them to be alternative and not meshed together.
Okay.
And so those are basically the rules that I was pointing out. Didn't have anything in particular on the other rules that were proposed there.
Okay.
Thank you for the time.
All right. Ryan Call. Yeah.
Good morning. My name is Ryan Call. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Hale Westfall here in Denver, and I am here not representing any particular candidate or political party or political organization, but here coming and speaking from the perspective of an election law practitioner, having practiced in this arena and in these matters for many years, and also in my capacity previously as an officer and members in leadership positions within political party organizations and other political organizations that are subject to the regulatory regime of Colorado's campaign finance laws as well as the federal regime. My comments today are going to be fairly brief, touch on a few of the observations that I have and that I've spoken with a few other folks about, do intend on later submitting written comments in a more detailed way to help the Secretary's office in considering some revisions to the proposed rules as they have been drafted. Specifically, I'd like to begin by observing that generally the amended proposed rules are very good and do much to eliminate some of the uncertainty and to assist committees and other entities and organizations that might be subject to Colorado's campaign finance regime in both complying with the Fair Campaign the Fair Campaign Practices Act, as well as knowing what kind of conduct would trigger that that activity. It also helps, I think, provide a much more fair and balanced and appropriate way to resolving some of the disputes that arise in the context of the complaint process. The Secretary's efforts to try to define what substantial compliance is and good faith, as well as provide important guidance to the administrative law courts in interpreting and applying campaign finance law, particularly in light of the whole body of case law and decisions both at the federal level, here in Colorado and throughout the country, to make every effort to have those rules be interpreted and applied consistently, particularly in the context of trying to draw as close as possible parallels or provide a common understanding of the way campaign finance law is applied at both the federal level and the state level to avoid some of the ambiguities or confusion or disparity that sometimes arises. While recognizing that Colorado does have its own unique regime, it does help, and I know the Secretary's office and the courts have often looked to the federal regime and federal court decisions for guidance. Specifically, I want to identify a couple of rules, however, that do, while appearing to have as their goal and aim certainty and consistency, as drafted, they actually create more ambiguities, more problems, and potentially many more traps for the unwary. Specifically, rules 1.7 and 3.3 could be read as currently drafted to prohibit conduct or create the opportunity for further complaints or challenges in a way that for the type of conduct that is both permissible under state law and under the federal in the federal context. Specifically, Rule 1.7, in attempting to provide some certainty as to the qualifications and draw distinctions between the status of an independent expenditure committee and a political committee, does not limit the use of its term coordination to the coordination of campaign-related expenditures. That is traditionally under both the Buckley versus Vallejo framework as well as a whole host of line of cases in at the federal and state level and in many jurisdictions. In fact, the overwhelming majority of jurisdictions around the country, what triggers regulatory what triggers the requirement to register and report and become regulated by the campaign finance regimes is conduct dealing with the expenditure side, not necessarily just the contribution or the coordination in a more generic sense. In particular, I might suggest for the Secretary's consideration amendments to Rule 1.7 to provide some limiting language that both provides an explicit embracing of the case law and other rules as provided by law, as well as some additions that might help provide some clarity. Specifically, Rule 1.7, I might suggest the insertion of the phrase "and except as otherwise provided for in these rules or by law," to follow the statutory reference to Section 145.103, paren 11.5 CRS, so that the new rule might emphasize that the Secretary is not intending to bypass that whole body of case law or interpretive comments by the courts, but instead is intending to embrace it and provide some clear guidance so that practitioners as well as committees can look to that past, those past decisions for some guidance. It also opens up the opportunity that other rules would not be read, this one would not be read to the exclusion of other rules. Specifically as well, I think the Independent Expenditure Committee definition or the distinction between that and a political committee needs to incorporate the idea that a political committee is unique in that it engages in express advocacy. That's not a concept that's identified here. While an Independent Expenditure Committee does as well, one of the key distinctions is that a political committee is a body that directly contributes to candidates, whereas an independent expenditure committee does not, and that the engaging in activity is focused on the coordination of campaign-related expenditures that are then coordinated with a candidate committee, or political party that are intended or designed to influence the outcome of elections. and embracing that idea that those campaign-related expenditures, not all expenditures, but those that are specifically campaign-related and intended or designed to or for the purpose of influencing the outcome of an election in support of that candidate or political party or candidate committee with whom they are coordinating is really the focus of that. I think it's also important in Rule 1.7 and potentially as well in Rule 3.3 provide a distinction between not just a political committee and an IEC, but also distinguish between a 527 political organization, as that entity is also subject to regulatory registration and reporting requirements as defined in 145.103.14.5 and Colorado's campaign finance laws. Similarly, Rule 3.3, in a very admirable and important attempt, is attempting to clear up when an expenditure is really a contribution to the candidate, but it doesn't incorporate the established and well-understood definition of a contribution or a coordinated expenditure that makes it a contribution and could potentially leave itself open to interpretation that would create more confusion rather than clarification. A couple of specific language the Secretary of State might consider, which we will, I'll probably provide in written comment later, maybe with further revision, could emphasize that the contribution that a political committee would make that would make it subject to being deemed to be a political committee has to be a direct contribution, not this business of an indirect contribution, unless that is then coordinated as a campaign-related expenditure. Either specifically identifying and maybe even citing or repeating the language of what constitutes a contribution that is in the Colorado Constitution and our Fair Campaign Practices Act, emphasizing that that contribution must be for the payment, loan, pledge, gift, or advance of money, guarantee of a loan, or the gift of or loan of property that is made by the political committee directly to the candidate committee or to the candidate for the purpose of promoting the candidate's nomination, retention, recall, or election. And emphasize that it is not just simply an expenditure, but instead a campaign-related expenditure that is made by the political committee that either constitutes express advocacy or is designed or intended to influence or attempt to influence the outcome of an election or to promote that candidate's nomination, retention, recall, or election. And I think it's important that in both 1.7 as well as 3.3, that the concepts of both express advocacy as well as this idea that it is the coordinated expenditure that constitutes a contribution that subjects the entity to regulation is the trigger. With that, I know there are a few other rules that others have commented on, and I'll leave that to some additional written comments that I'll submit later, but I wanted to call those to the committee and to this group's attention, as well as if there's any questions that you all have, I'm certainly happy to answer them from my perspective.
Any questions? No? All right. Thank you very much. Matt Arnold.
Good morning. My name is Matt Arnold. I'm here representing myself as a citizen of the state and also as director of Campaign Integrity Watchdog, the state's premier enforcer of the state's campaign finance laws, having successfully prosecuted more violators than any other organization in the state's history, including a number of cases against Mr. Call, who just testified, attempting to overturn the results of several court cases. Go through a number of the rules that, and again, I'm just following up on the written comments, which expanded on more depth on this, but I'll just make a couple of points here. Rule 1.6, it's odd that the Secretary wants to eliminate this rule, since it's the Secretary who actually instituted this rule in an attempt to clarify the law. And so going back on that actually introduces more confusion and lack of clarity rather than uphold the law that has been in place for almost 4 years, that made very clear that it is not simply express advocacy or expenditures as narrowly defined, which must be disclosed, but actually did uphold the overall purpose of the Article 28 and the Act, the Fair Campaign Practices Act, promoting full transparency, full and timely disclosure, not just picking and choosing what a committee might define as an expenditure under the law. So this elimination of Rule 1.6 is a step backwards in transparency and accountability and in upholding the overall purpose of the article and the act. A couple of other folks here have commented on Rule 1.7 and Rule 3.3. Those are kind of in tandem. The attempt by the Secretary to redefine the constitutional and statutory language, which very clearly lay out what the qualifications or requirements are to be a political committee under the constitutional definition and under the statutory definition. The proposed rule adds an element to the statutory language, which is simply not only not there in the constitutional or statutory language, but is expressly against what is in the constitutional and statutory language and, oh, by the way, contradicts several court rulings both in the at the federal level and at the state level. And I'm not going to cite all those. I can rattle them off. They're in the written comments. Again, this rule is an attempt to rewrite by regulation the constitutional and statutory language. It grossly exceeds the authority of the Secretary of State. It directly contradicts what is in the Constitution and what is in statute, and does so in an attempt to essentially provide a favor to the political allies of the current Secretary of State. It's deeply troubling and very problematic that the Secretary would attempt to rewrite by regulation, again, vastly exceeding his authority, what is clearly laid out in the Constitution, in the statute, and in numerous court cases. Proposed Rule 1.21, sort of related to that, attempting to rewrite clear constitutional language defining the political committee. By adding an element of coordination into the definition that simply, again, does not exist in constitutional language, in statutory language, and directly contradicts numerous court cases. And not only that, it's logically impossible. The definition of political committee includes contributions or expenditures made or accepted to oppose candidates. It is logically impossible to impose a coordination requirement on a committee that exists or operates to oppose candidates. How does that work? Does one, as a committee opposing a candidate, go up to that candidate one is opposing and say, excuse me, candidate X, we're about to drop a whole bunch of mailers in your district opposing you. Do you mind? Is it okay if we do that? It's logically impossible. So trying to write in that element, which does not exist in constitutional or statutory language, is simply not supported in the law, nor in federal and state jurisprudence. Again, getting back to 3.3, you know, this has been explicitly rejected in a number of cases, starting at the federal level, including in Citizens United, which made very clear that the element of coordination is not required to impose the disclosure requirements under federal law. And the same then applies to Colorado state law, which is closely modeled on that federal law. I did have a question about the proposed Rule 4.6. Again, this rule seems to contradict the rule that that links issue committee registration with title designation for the ballot. And just, again, the question is, would it not make more sense to tie the election cycle for an issue committee with the election cycle for the supported or opposed ballot measure appears in the ballot? Again, as this rule seems to actually add confusion rather than decrease it. Can you comment on that?
This is meant to clarify that it's really when the title is set and then clarify the election cycle. So, I mean, if you have other language you want to...
I'll follow up on that. Again, it seems to contradict what happens there, linking the issue committee cycle to what's going to be on the ballot. That would appear to be a more straightforward way of addressing that. And I agree that that does require some clarification. I just don't believe that the current language achieves that goal. Um, Rule 10.2.3, again, this is a problematic attempt by the Secretary to reverse the constitutional requirement to return undocumented contributions to the source within 30 days, and that constitutional requirement exists independently of reporting requirements. Again, this is an attempt to rewrite the law and reverse existing case law, in which we have findings of fact and findings of law that those are, in fact, separate issues. They are separate violations, and they are a separate issue. So attempting to write that out of existence, write the statutory requirement, the constitutional requirement out of existence in contradiction to recent case law, exceeds the Secretary's authority and is just disallowable. Rule 10.4.6, Ms. Pearl commented on that earlier. Again, this appears to be yet another attempt to rewrite the law for the benefit of political allies, and also seeks to attempt to overturn recent court rulings, which found unambiguously that, yes, a check that is written by one person in accordance to the Secretary of State's guidance, which is very clear and has existed for a number of years, only can come from the person writing the check. A committee may not presumptively assume that it can be split between two different people, particularly when the split is not necessarily an even split, as has occurred in a number of cases. So for the Secretary of State to attempt to rewrite and overturn recent case law by a rule is highly problematic and again, increases confusion rather than decreases confusion. It's very straightforward. The person writing the check is a contributor. That is a fairly simple principle and very simple to apply. It makes it a lot more clear for the committees when receiving a check written by person Y that it, in fact, comes from person Y. They don't have to guess. They don't have to engage in mind reading. They don't have to make presumptions about how to split it. It simply comes from the person writing the check. Very straightforward. So, again, attempting to rewrite that law and increase the amount of guesswork actually, again, increases confusion, it decreases transparency, and it makes litigation actually much more likely, because then a litigant or a complainant can come in and say, look, person Y wrote this check, very clearly the case, it exceeded the contribution limits. The committee presumptively decided to portion the amount between two different people, and that different person is not part of that check or part of that contribution. There's no paper trail for that. It actually increases confusion, and I believe increases the likelihood of litigation and complaints. Again, very straightforward. Keep the rule as it is. Again, a request for clarification on Rule 12.4. The question is, does this proposed rule also apply to committees with outstanding obligations, particularly outstanding obligations owed the state pursuant to delinquent reporting and or adjudication that are not otherwise allowed to be terminated?
Yes.
That's the question. So it would.
Yes.
It would let committees that actually have outstanding obligations off the hook.
Wouldn't let them off the hook. It would let them close their accounts if they have zero reports and no activity within that period.
But again, the language is quite clear that a committee that has outstanding obligations currently is not allowed to terminate. So this would, again, allow committees that have outstanding obligations owed the state, in many cases could be thousands or tens of thousands of dollars, to simply fold up shop and go away. Is that the intent?
The intent is that they could terminate so they don't have to continue reporting if there is no activity.
But they still have outstanding obligations. So, in effect, there is activity because they're continuing to accrue, at the very least, interest, which should be owed the state. So you're letting these lawbreakers off the hook when they owe the state money and presumably would owe the state more money by allowing them to fold up shop and slink off into the sunset. Is that your intent?
That's your words. I've answered your question.
So that is your intent. Thank you. In that case, again, that is a highly problematic rule, and we oppose it. Couple of other things have been touched upon. Proposed rule 18.2 and the various subsets of that. 18.21A, it's common sense. It certainly makes sense. 18.2.1B, problematic there because you're imposing a requirement to include in a complaint the email address. Now, that is something that may or may not be known. So would support that by adding the words if known, because many organizations or individuals may not, if they have not filed and there's a complaint against an organization which is not registered, then the email address may not be known. So imposing that as a requirement would make it impossible to hold accountable those organizations that have completely violated the law and completely failed to engage in any form of disclosure or registration whatsoever. So that, by imposing that as a requirement, would make it impossible to hold such egregiously law-breaking organizations accountable. So without adding the words, if known, that would impose essentially an impossible to fulfill requirement in many cases, and I believe that is neither constitutionally nor statutorily permissible. 18.2.1C, I think that's consistent in terms of generally providing a notice and due process. No issues with that one. Again, a couple of requests for clarification on 18.2.2 and 18.2.3. The question is, does the Secretary intend with these proposed amendments to eliminate electronic filing of campaign finance complaints in their entirety and force complainants to travel to the Secretary's office in Denver to file hard copy only complaints? Once again, if that is the case, that is very problematic for those who reside outside the Denver metro area.
That is not the intent. The intent is to clarify that you must, your complaint is not complete until your affidavit is filed.
Okay, well, I think that the current language already allows that. So again, and I'll submit some language that maybe might help make that a bit more clear. I think in general, it's somewhat problematic to, in this day and age, here we are in the second decade of the 21st century, to preclude the electronic submission of documents. To require a hard copy complaint really is sort of harkening back to the last millennium. I think we can kind of catch up with that and should allow a wholly electronic filing of complaints rather than impose an additional hard copy requirement. I believe that otherwise you're sort of disproportionately affecting those living outside the Denver metro area, and I believe imposing an unconstitutional additional burden based on geography, depriving complainants of due process and the exercise of a constitutionally guaranteed right under the Constitution's Article 28, Section 9.2 alpha. Again, I think this is something that could be worked, but I believe that the current language that mandates a hard copy is somewhat problematic and certainly neither practical nor consistent with where we are in the world. 18.2.3, again, attempting to impose a substantial compliance standard on campaign finance regulations and adherence to those. Once again, this specifically contradicts recent jurisprudence in this state. Case number 15, CA 1110, Campaign Integrity Watchdog versus Dan Thurlow, 55, certiorari denied, was on 27 March 2017, specifically addressed this issue. Quote, Article 5 falls outside of the substantial compliance mandate based on the plain language of the statutes in Article 1.
Right, but that was before the passage of House Bill 1155, so this is addressing the implementation of that bill.
It addresses the implementation of the bill, but the problem is that a statute cannot overturn constitutional language. So,
our purposes, statutes are presumed constitutional, and it's our job to implement the statute. So that's what this rule does.
So this rule is attempting, essentially, to overturn a Court of Appeals ruling which held quite clearly that the substantial compliance standard does not apply to adjudication of campaign
this
finance
rule,
violations.
This rule is implementing House Bill 1155.
This rule is attempting to overturn Court of Appeals ruling.
it's not attempting to overturn anything. If a law comes into place after a court ruling, the court is interpreting the law at that point. A court interpretation today may be different based on House Bill 1155. This is seeking to interpret that bill.
And that bill, of course, is a deeply problematic constitutionality in any event. Rule 18.2.4, the attempt to impose a percentage-based test on good faith compliance is again, not only unsupported in constitutional and statutory language, as previous testifiers have commented, it also runs directly counter to express and unambiguous statements of purpose in the article, which and the statute, as well as extant case law and decisions. Again, a couple of those. We have, 15 CA 1110, which made clear that good faith is not a standard. Also, the attempts to create a percentage-based good standard compliance standard is not only in contradiction to that constitutional and statutory language, but also it goes against a number of other cases that have addressed this attempt to adjudicate good faith or compliance based on a percentage. It'd be the same thing if you're trying to say that for a traffic violation. Someone could just, by the same logic, would appear in court and say, Your Honor, yes, I got popped for speeding 20 miles an hour over the speed limit on Tuesday the 4th of the month. But Your Honor, I drive that road every other day. And for the 30 other days of the month, I was in compliance with the law. I was not found guilty of speeding on those other days. In fact, I drive that route twice, back and forth. So, Your Honor, really, one out of 60 times, I have been popped for speeding. Your Honor, I'm in substantial compliance with the law to observe the speed limits.
Right.
And that same logic is being applied to violations of campaign finance law. Yes, it might be one out of 60 entries, but it's still a violation.
Right. But, Mr. Arnold, your complaint is with the law. If the speeding law said that as long as you are in substantial compliance with the speed limits, then you could come in and make these same arguments. And then you could go complain that the speeding law is no longer strict liability, that there's now this substantial compliance component in it. But that's a complaint with the law. That's what the law says now.
The law does not say that substantial compliance is the standard. I know you attempted to rewrite that and change the law, but again, that goes against the constitutional language, which sets a more strict standard. And again, the express purpose of the article is not that a loosey-goosey substantial compliance standard applies to violations of campaign finance regulations or rules or laws. Again, I believe that this is a blatant attempt to rewrite the law and apply a standard which simply is not supported in the Constitution or in statute. Rule 18.4, again, a problem here with both the constitutional and statutory mandates imposed on the office of the Secretary of State for collection of debts owed the state. And this is in violation of his fiduciary duties and apparently for the benefit of his political allies. Again, the Secretary of State has refused to collect debts owed the state predominantly by allies of the current secretary and not more generally. This is deeply problematic and again, talks to the issue of corruption that was the overriding purpose of the act in the first place. The Secretary's proposed rule would effectively preclude collection of debts that are due the state from any and all non-candidate committees by eliminating the data information necessary for the controller to institute collection. And that is, again, mandated by law. So, by eliminating that, the committee registered agent, who is the legal designee for the service of legal proceedings, including collection of debt, by eliminating that from the information required to be provided, this would eviscerate the constitutional and statutory mandate for a collection of debt. So, in summation, again, repeal of Rule 1.6 would undermine and detract from uniformity in the administration of current law. Rule 1.7 and Rule 3.3 would undermine and detract from uniformity in administration of the current law and runs counter to both constitutional and statutory language. Again, there is no coordination requirement. Mr. Call's attempt to introduce an express advocacy requirement is also not supported either in the express language of the Constitution or the statute or in extant federal and state case law. The Secretary of State cannot exceed his authority to rewrite the Constitution and rewrite statute by writing rules. And that's precisely what Rule 1.7 and Rule 3.3 and the corollary rules changes are attempting to do. Again, the rulemaking authority is limited to rules as may be necessary to administer and enforce any provision of Article 28, not to rewrite the law. And that is precisely what many of these rule changes are attempting to do. And again, because these are, many of these rule changes are not only done with the intent to benefit political allies and in some
cases
campaign
contributors. Okay, Mr. Arnold, you've said that before, and we're not going to have any more personal. You've already said it. I've let you say it. You said it twice. We're done with that line of argument.
Is it not the case? Did you not, in fact, coordinate with many of these organizations?
Mr. Arnold, this is not an interrogatory. This is not a cross-examination. You can make your comments. I've let you make your comments. If you have anything new to add, go ahead and add it.
Again, if the Secretary of State is engaging in misconduct, that's an issue.
Mr. Arnold, we're done. Okay, it seems to me you've made your comments. You've provided what you have of substance. If you have anything new to add, you can add it. But we're not going to go into any more personal attacks, and this is not a Q&A.
Claire, this is not it's not a personal attack. This is addressing the overall purpose of the article and the act. And if, in fact, the Secretary of State is attempting to undermine the express constitutional and statutory language and is doing so for the benefit of other parties, this is a big issue. This is not a personal issue. It's not a personal attack on anybody. It's getting at the purpose of the article to provide for transparency and accountability.
This is not a Q&A. It's for you to make comments, and now you're just trying to draw out an argument. If you have further comments, you can make your comment.
Ms. Sartre, again, the comment is that many of these proposed rules changes appear to have been made for purposes other than what was laid out in the announcement. They appear to have been made for the benefit of certain organizations and individuals that are allied with the current Secretary of State. They quite clearly undermine the express constitutional and statutory language of the article and of the Fair Campaign Practices Act. That is deeply problematic. The Secretary of State, I believe, is exceeding, not only doing so for the wrong purposes, but is exceeding his authority by attempting to rewrite the law by regulation. And with that, I'll conclude.
Thank you. All right, is there anybody else who's present who wishes to testify on these rules? All right, then with that, that concludes our hearing. The time is 10:30, and as I stated at the beginning of the hearing, the record will remain open until next Tuesday, close of business, for anyone who wishes to submit written comments. So thank you very much, and we are adjourned.